Welcome to That Anthro Podcast, the podcast dedicated to anthropology. Together, each week, we will be learning from the experts and researchers that are researching our pasts and today's problems. My name is Gabriella Campbell, and I'll be interviewing a new guest each week to bring to you the latest and greatest in anthropology, based right here out of Santa Barbara. Join me for weekly episodes, whether you're an anthropology buff or looking to learn something new. Welcome to That Anthro Podcast. And now, a word about the sponsor of our podcast, Anchor. Hi, Adam. Welcome to That Anthro Podcast. Thank you so much for being here today. For our listeners, the name Adam Gamwell may ring a few bells because he has actually been the host of This Anthro Life, an extremely popular podcast for 7 years now, which is insane to me. So I'll turn it over to Adam to kind of further explain about your podcast generally and like what types of guests and subjects you dive into on This Anthro Life.
Cool. Thanks for having me, Gabby. It's a pleasure to be here. Or have a bi-coastal recording that we're doing right now, which is cool. So pleasure to be here online with you. And I also appreciate your 3-word podcast name. It's the way to go. I think it's three words just bounce off the tongue really easily. And also wise to shorten anthropology to anthro. It's funny when we first made This Anthro Life, it was This Anthropological Life, which takes way more time to say, and then just over time, it was like anthro, it just feels a little bit better. But as you noted, I've been doing the podcast for 7 years now, which is crazy. That's a long time. It's as long as a graduate degree.
Yeah.
So it's interesting that the show has changed a number of ways over the years, but just in a broad sense, the kinds of guests we have would be anthropologists, as one can imagine, which could be professors of anthropology, could be graduate students. We've had internal conversations between myself and different co-hosts that we've had over the years. I've probably worked with 6 or 7 different co-hosts, all different kinds of anthropologists, from, cultural anthropologists to archaeologists to bioanthropologists to linguistic experts. And subjects is pretty anything under the sun, more or less. When we originally started doing the show, we would pick a topic like beer or dreams or Burning Man. And basically, say this week we're doing Burning Man, and have either a friend that has gone to Burning Man come talk about it, and or we just kind of internally do some research and talk about garbage. And so basically it's kind of a follow your nose series of episodes. And today it's a little different, where it's mostly a guest focused show. And so it's me talking with guests. And so it's often basically what they're working on, or if they have a new book out or something like that. So it's been a shift over the years, but it's been super fun. One way to think about it for me is that TAL now kind of aims to capture that feeling when you hear somebody say, "Oh, anthropology, that was my favorite class in college. I only took one, but it's the class I'm always going to remember." That's the vibe that I want to kind of bring out with this show.
I love that. And, I haven't listened to any of those earlier episodes where it's, like you said, kind of like a group of you and your friends. But honestly, you should bring those back and do I don't know, how many people would you originally do it with? Like two or three?
Three of us. Yeah.
Okay. You should bring that back. But we can do it online and then pick a subject and then just dive into something. That'd be fun.
Totally.
Yeah.
Yeah. We can do it. We can do a This Anthro Live version of that, right?
It's something ever since the panel that you and I did together, which I'll bring up later for anyone that's interested in watching it. I loved that experience. It was my first panel, and I really think the idea of having a live streamed rather than a physically live, at a conference or something, it's just so unique. And it really brings so many different people and different diverse thoughts. I really loved it. And so I'm totally been ever since then planning how to do something next. But also school is keeping me on my toes. We're back to the first week, back to the first week of classes, and the registrar is trying to drop me out of 2 of my classes. UCSB registrar, you're mean.
Hashtag save Gabby. Anthropology does have to fight. Actually, when I was in graduate school too, there was a moment when we were going through an economic recession. Folks might remember from 2008 up until 2016. And at the time, the university, when we were doing our master's, I went to Brandeis University, they were trying to find ways to save money, and they were considering cutting the anthro graduate program.
And while everyone's in the middle of their graduate studies.
Yes, right. And one of our colleagues, she was doing her PhD at the time. She had put she had put signs in the windows that said Department of Low Hanging Fruit as a protest, which is good. We didn't get cut.
Clearly, it's like you're here today with your degree.
Yeah.
which I actually think is a good transition. Like, you know, your educational background, and I've heard you call this Anthro Life a form of like graduate school therapy. So mm-hmm. you said you were attending graduate school at Brandeis. What kind of were you studying, and like, how do you kind of label yourself in anthropology? What do you study and focus your research on?
Yeah, totally. It's funny. So, you know, obviously I do a podcast. And so the way that we'll talk about this and to kind of tell my story is that it's like a parallel lives, but parallel learnings, you know, both in terms of doing the graduate research and what I did for graduate school and then the podcast. And so they'll weave in together. But so on the academic side, I you know, did both my master's and my PhD at Brandeis University, which is outside of Boston and Massachusetts. And I my PhD was focused on like geographically in the Andes, like Peru, and, you know, and mm. and the Andes Mountains. It could be also be, you know, Bolivia and parts of southern Colombia and Ecuador. But I was focused in Peru and on food. And so when I first started doing PhD research, I was actually studying transnational shepherds and sheep rearing.
Wow.
And which is interesting, right? And yeah. So there's actually one of these, I don't remember the statistic anymore, but it was something like, you know, at least 75% of the sheep and mutton raised in the United States is raised by Peruvians. And that kind of blew my mind. And that most of them are migrant shepherds that come up and down from Peru back to the US and basically live by themselves in the Western United States with like one guy, a shotgun, a Jeep, and 2,000 sheep, you know. Wow. And this really interesting, like very kind of quiet and isolating existence. And that was kind of interesting just in terms of like, how does food and food chains bring people together like this? And then I was having trouble kind of connecting because it's like, how do you find a shepherd out in the middle of Wyoming? You know, not impossible. And especially if some of these, you know, migrants don't speak English very well, and some of them don't speak Spanish that well too. They might speak Quechua, for example. Mm. And so in 2012, 2013, when I started a PhD in 2013, my graduate program said, you should go to Peru to learn Quechua, or at least learn some of it to get started. And I said, that sounds cool. And so I, you know, kind of booked my first, you know, graduate field trip down to Peru and enrolled in a Quechua language program in Cusco. And while I was there, I was trying to develop some contacts and just see what was happening kind of on the land. And the house mother that I lived with, she said, you should go to this city called Ayaviri. It's about 2 to 4 hours south. And they're shepherds. That's a shepherding area of southern Peru. Okay. So I got on a bus and went down there and was trying to figure out, how do I find shepherds here, which is also quite difficult. And it was a very interesting time because I was living with a host family and I had classmates and I was learning Quechua in Cusco. And it was like, Cusco is one of those cities that you've probably at least heard of Machu Picchu. That's how you get to Machu Picchu. So a lot of tourists, a lot of like, you know, quote unquote, Western or foreign influences as part of it that really mix, and a lot of like hippies go there. So it on one level felt like home. But then when I went to Ayaviri, it like hit me. I was like, this is you. You're the white dude. You're like a foot taller than most other people. And you're the only person that doesn't speak Spanish that well at all here, you know? And it was like this very interesting moment of culture shock. And it's an important part of being an anthropologist, I think, to have this happen. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so I was trying to, you know, basically poke around in this small city and see where I could meet some shepherds. And I wasn't really finding anybody because also this makes sense. The shepherds are out doing shepherd work. They're not like yeah. hanging out in Ayaviri. So I'm like, hold on, house mother, good start. But like, how do I get to the next part? So I was just walking around the city one day, and then I stumbled upon a quinoa production house, little plant. And, you know, I was there to study food, and quinoa had been in my head, because again, studying food, like superfoods was something that was kind of like ringing in my head of something else that might be interesting to look at. And Peru is known for being a superfood hub of the world.
Yeah. And quinoa was domesticated there and, you know, can only be grown above like 6,000 feet. It's super interesting.
Yeah. It's a crazy plant.
Yeah.
And so, you know, that little light bulb said, okay, we'll go check out what's happening. See if they'll talk to you. And so basically I walked in and, you know, said, I'm an anthropologist and I'm studying food and I'm interested in this. And they just said, come on in. And they invited me to stay with them. And I was like, there's something here, you know, I'm having trouble yeah. finding shepherds, and quinoa invited me in. So maybe we'll go here. And that kind of basically helped set my path forward in terms of what I studied. So ultimately for my research, I did work on quinoa conservation and commercialization, and basically how different forms of knowledge, basically indigenous scientists, agricultural scientists, international NGOs, government agencies, how all these different groups work together, like in what forces shape how we produce quinoa and for what reasons. Is it for conservation? Is it for commercialization? But something else that is important about why this path happened this way is that when I kind of found my way looking into this, I realized that this kind of work, I wasn't comfortable just doing a traditional ethnography in terms of, let me just go do a study and then I'm going to pop back and that's it. Especially because if we're looking at working with marginalized populations, there's always power differentials that we have to account for. But then on top of that, like working with quinoa for questions of commercialization and conservation has implications for things like climate change and environmental resilience. And so I wanted to find a way to do work that would have an impact beyond my own study. And serendipity happens in funny ways when you're kind of open to it, you know? And
definitely.
I was literally just looking at, you know, quinoa articles, and I found this one little two-pager article that was, you know, didn't have any citations on it. It was just like, here's facts about quinoa production in Peru. And it was interesting. So, and at the bottom, it said, email this person if you want to know more about the citations. And I said, yeah, it's weird that they're not there.
So I'm trying to imagine like an article. Yeah. Yeah, that would be weird.
You're like, huh? I mean, it wasn't a journal article. It was just like some, you know, some pamphlet or something, you know? Yeah. It would be, if it's a journal article, I'd be like, what journal is this? You know, but then I saw emailed, and it was part of a publication for an NGO or a research for development nonprofit called Bioversity International. And so I met the director of the program that works on food conservation in a number of countries, and told them what I was doing and looking to do. And I'm going to Peru in a few months. And he was like, we need help doing research. Do you want to come do stuff with us? And then I was like, yeah. And so the quinoa doors kept going and said, you should come do these things. And so then it was like, I could link up with a, you know, research for development nonprofit. So like they were already doing work for, again, development work for conservation. And it also opened up this really interesting sort of bifurcation of what we do education for. And on one level, it's like, you know, when we go do field work, whether it is for biological anthropology, for archaeology, for cultural anthro, you know, there's like the research that we have to do that's part of our graduate education. Like you're, you know, if you go to graduate school, even if you're doing a thesis now for undergrad, like you have to say, here's my goals, here's what I'm going to go do, and here's what I'm going to produce and bring back from the field. And that has to happen. But at the same time, when you're working with a partnership, you know, like if you're working with an archaeological firm or like a local government or local group, they have their needs too, right? And so then you have this, you have to kind of balance what these different organizations need. And that was a interesting and challenging thing to kind of mix because as a cultural anthropologist, you know, it was a bit of like, what are my dissertation requirements? But then also how does the NGO get what they need out of this too? And so it's a bit of back and forth in terms of like how I ended up doing this kind of the study work. But yeah, so quinoa really became this thing. So it was fun. It was a hipster dissertation, I guess, you know, on one level in terms of looking at these different processes. And it was super fun to kind of realize that simple examples that the different names for different kinds of quinoa, like if you go shopping in the grocery store, we go to Whole Foods or something, we can see there's black quinoa and red quinoa and white quinoa, right? But in Peru, there's like 26 different kinds you can get. There's a ton of different varieties. I got to go hang out in like seed banks and gene banks and see thousands and thousands of different genetic accessions of quinoa. And I have like 15 kinds here at my house, just little sample jars, all different colors, super crazy. And then just to realize to your point, like they can grow in different altitudes. It grows in crappy and salty and saline soils. You know, and there are some varieties that can grow at sea level. There's some that can grow at super high, like, you know, 12,000 feet up is where I did most of my research in Puno and the Altiplano. And so it's just such a, I don't know, super fascinating plant and an arena of just these, you know, super with it farmers. You know, they're like, they're both incredibly humble, but so knowledgeable. And you know, they have these, you know, they exhibit these qualities that we, you know, we, I think, wistfully look towards in the West of like, oh, you could look at that and recognize the soil and the quality of this and that. And like, you know, some of these kind of hippie values. Even though they themselves are not hippies. And so it's interesting to like also just put these pieces into the equation of how do we think about how conservation should happen, right? What are we looking for? And also, what does that mean for the people that are doing it? What is like, how does it affect their well-being, for example?
Yeah, how does it affect like the life ways of the people actually producing quinoa? And I think also then like in turn, like asking for what they want out of it, you know, as the quinoa farmers themselves, like what did they want in that industry of like, because I'm assuming most of them are like selling it, not just like consuming mm-hmm. it just for their family.
That's right.
Yeah. So I'm curious, like how the podcast became kind of therapeutic during your grad school journey. And it sounds like you were pretty busy, you know, how did like you end up starting it through all of the, you know, writing a thesis and dissertation process?
Yeah, that's a good question. The podcast began in 2013. And so I began PhD in 2012. And so then basically within that first year, around the first year, I started working on it. And in part, it was because, you know, me and two of my classmates at the time, we would find ourselves hanging out at the bar or something after class and be talking about something that we read that day, you know, Marx's theory of dialectical materialism or something, or, you know, Franz Boas's historical particularism. And one thing to know about me is that I really love anthropological theory. Like I love the $500 words that we come up with, like the super expensive sounding phrases. Like they're both ridiculous and also just really fun, I think.
But what is ridiculous.
Not, they're ridiculous, right?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, emic and edic, right? The sort of insider outsider perspective, like mm-hmm. the fact that we say emic and edic is ridiculous, you know, yeah. it's cool. But, anyway, so I love that kind of stuff, but what is not cool is that it's so hard to explain what these things are, in a quick and easy way. And so the first like level of therapy in this case was that how can we have a conversation around these really interesting topics or really interesting ways that we are understanding what it means to be human or understanding how to understand humans. Again, even this idea of like the emic and edic insider and outsider perspective, what does it mean to do that? Or what does it mean to, you know, unpack the idea, and we're not even going to go here, but like Bruno Latour's idea that we've never been modern. Like we don't have a separation between like a subject and an object the way that we think we do. Like that's super deep philosophy, but like at the same time, it's really interesting to contemplate. Yeah, wait, we think that we're like qualitatively different from quote unquote ancient humans, but we're not. And why is that? Why do we think that we're somehow, the Europeans are somehow like more advanced quote unquote than mm-hmm. other peoples, right? Why is that? And that's really hard to unpack quickly. And so on one level, the podcast gave us an opportunity to explore those questions in a conversational format. And, you know, the helpful part is like being at a bar was, you know, you have a beer, you have a libation. We occasionally say, hey, that's a great way of saying that. We should have recorded that. And so then we basically just decided to do that. And we went and parked ourselves at the Brandeis radio station and got, you know, certified to use the board and got Ooh. A slot for a weekly show and just started doing it. And so it was really just a you know, kind of a proof of concept. Let's just have a conversation once a week, you know. And it was helpful to, again, just to have like a schedule, like this is whatever time it was, you know, it changed every semester. And that became really important for that in terms of that it was a new kind of way of building an identity around having conversational anthropology. And that made a big difference to me. The therapy side of it actually changed as graduate school went on. And so this is not a warning story to people that are going to go to graduate school if you're interested in it. But like, I personally think that graduate school is like the intellectual precision that anthropology requires is super exciting and incredibly exhausting. And I think that graduate school is unnecessarily hard or difficult on people, and it doesn't need to be. Mm-hmm. And so for me, one simple example is I'm actually a really slow reader, and that's very frustrating, especially in graduate school. You know, cause you got to read a ton of stuff all the time. And it's just like, I couldn't keep up. And like, that didn't make sense to me. Cause it's like, I can work on theories. I can work on the ideas and we can put things together, but just like, I can't read 400 pages every few days, you know, or I can't do that and sleep.
Yeah.
You know,
I can't do that and focus on and engage with what I'm reading. Like, yes. There's no way I could read too. The 400 pages, but I'm not going to remember or like retain any of it.
Right. You know, we even get taught things like, you know, this is how you can skim this or like pay attention to that. And I'm like, then what's the point of having a 400 page book? You know, if the point is to skim it, then give me the cliff notes, you know? So, you know, again, not to hate on graduate school at all, but like, but yeah, there's issues that I think we like anthropology, and I think graduate life and academia in general is doing some important soul searching right now. Mm-hmm. And it should
be. There's some flaws, and I really hope that, you know, we're like working them out, because definitely not a perfect system right now.
Right. Yeah. No, 100%, you know? And so, you know, there's these issues, you know, but there's other things like, you know, there's the stress of getting paid nothing, or being very paid very low. There's this culture of overachievement, like both among students and faculties. You want to be the best. And there's always that one or two people in the department that's always like doing way too good. And you're like, how is this even happening? Mm-hmm. Future job uncertainty, you know, and like career guidance is tricky. I mean, I'm not sure how it is now and I know not every school is the same, and so I'm not saying this is bad on Brandeis, but just like, you know, most professors only know how to teach you to go into academia. And I wasn't sure that's what I wanted to do. And so it was really tricky to find other outlets or ways of figuring out who to talk to and who to figure that out with. And so for me, podcasting was a little bit of a reprieve from these kinds of pressures, but then also gave this space to explore other kinds of avenues of conversations. And, you know, I don't know how early on how people found the show, but we would get folks reaching out to us. Andy Simon, who is a colleague, a longtime colleague now, she's a really wonderful corporate anthropologist. She's had her own practice for years. And early on in our show, she reached out to be a guest on it. And that was super validating for us, because it was a business. I didn't even know what business anthropology was. You know, this is like 2014. And, you know, so to have a business anthropologist say, hey, I'd love to talk on your show. We're like, wait, okay, hold on. There's other conversations out there that are happening that we don't even know about, you know, as naive as that sounds, right? And so there was a huge validation of like that this is happening. And part of this, remember, this is 2014. So this is before Serial, the podcast, came out, which is from This American Life. So podcasting wasn't this really mainstream thing. Like right now, it's like, we're talking before we were recording about, we both love Dax Shepard and an Armchair Expert. Like celebrities have podcasts now, which you think about it is the epitome of like, we've Americanized this thing, right? But aside from that, like, you know, so this wasn't really a super well-known thing. So we hadn't thought about things like marketing, or thought about like, how do we get the show to grow, right? How do we help people find it? Besides, we have a radio show. And so there's all these avenues that began to open up because of this medium that we just decided to play with. And so for me, again, there was, I don't know. So it's like a very windy therapy, but it's provided again, this like sense of identity and career development that has grown with me in ways that academia wouldn't or couldn't do. And that was just important for me to be able to, you know, be able to explore and have fun and be creative in this way. So yeah, I think that's my therapy.
That's great. I have a quick Armchair Expert question for you. What every time Dax brings up that he has an anthropology degree, I'm like, Dax, we all know, God bless your little heart, that you were out of your mind drunk or high the entire time. And like, he'll bring up these little anthro things, and he's always very accurate when he does bring them up. But I always just kind of sigh when he goes, well, yeah, I have an anthropology degree. And I'm all, come on, Dax.
You're like, okay, really? Yeah.
You really? Which is not to discredit like his intellect, because he is like a very intelligent person. It's also like he got a BA probably 30 years ago, and he's now, that maybe 20 years ago. I don't know how old he is. And now he's like a parent. Still, so he brings it up, and I'm always, oh, Dax, come on. No, let's not.
I know. It's like you probably get more dose of anthropology now reading Medium than you did from your degree 20 years ago, you know.
Yeah. How have your goals and episode structure kind of changed throughout these 7 years and 137 episodes? I looked it up. That's craziness. I mean, I'm just like, this episode with you will be my 36th. So hey, the idea, thank you. So the idea of, you know, being in the hundreds is insane for me. Where do you kind of see it progressing in the future?
Yeah. Just a side note, it's like 150 episodes, you're fine. You're not wrong. It's just because that's how many episodes exist online, this is a warning for podcasters. Old formats will cut off episode numbers after a while. And so I have to go find the old episodes actually. So you're totally correct from what you see. But like WordPress, like cut off the episodes a while ago, which is very strange.
Oh, that's interesting.
This is a totally unnecessary parenthetical site, but, So the show has changed a number of ways in terms of, you know, originally it was three of us, three graduate students working on the show. And then it moved to two, and then it just became me. And this is in part because I love podcasting. Like this medium matters to me as a thing to do. Right. Mm-hmm. And my other colleagues, like they're both great. Ryan Collins and Anil Tripathi, who started the show. They both are going on and doing their own great things. You know, Ryan's an archaeologist and Neil's an economic anthropologist, and they're both doing really cool postdoc work right now. And you know, like, I guess podcasting is like my version of a postdoc, you know? And so it's the thing that I wanted to keep going with. Like it's this kind of work I love. And so in part it's changed because, you know, the hosts have changed, you know, it's now me from the original team, but you know, the show has really kind of followed my career interests on one level. Like again, it began these old school episodes, as we said before, of like three of us kind of talking about garbage or commuting, to now it's, you know, a real focus has been on how do we demonstrate the value of anthropological thinking and doing to folks out in the world, you know, and, to today it's that also, but then it's really just, you know, also sometimes I might be the only anthropological connection on the show. Like I don't always have anthropologists on the show. I'll have a cyber psychologist, or I had a neuromarketer, team, like a neuroscientist and a marketer, come on. I have anthropologists also, but, it's been really interesting to sometimes when like challenge yourself to be the anthropologist in the room and then help others see why an anthropological perspective is interesting or useful. You know, I just did a recording for an episode that will come out probably after this one airs, with a CEO and like a career coach and the founder of this really great company called Maker Kids that's about teaching kids coding and social skills together. She's not an anthropologist. And when we first started talking, she was talking like, you know, a little skepticism of why are we on an anthropology kind of show. And it was a really cool conversation to think about how does anthropology help us inform these kinds of questions in the way that we approach other kinds of business and other kinds of work. So for me, it's like this really exciting piece of letting other kinds of groups of people in industries and organizations see the value of anthropological thinking and doing out in the world. I mean, the caveat with this too is like, so I have, since finishing PhD, I have, we'll talk a bit about teaching in a little bit, I think, but like, I have worked as an independent consultant and, you know, and I currently work in consumer research and industry now. And because of that, so I kind of work on the other side of the fence anyway. So I'm kind of in these both worlds. And so part of the goals of the shows have shifted because, a lot of people began asking me conversations and questions across like, how did you do that? How did you make that career move? How did you get from academia to this? And I realized that like for myself too, like I had to figure this out and kind of wade through the darkness and find other people that had done it before me. And so for me, one of the goals of the podcast now is to help people understand their career options as anthropologists, right? That there's so much kind of work that we can do, which is super exciting and awesome. And industries want anthropologists, like they want archaeologists, they want cultural anthropologists, they want bioanthropists, thinkers. I mean, there is like things that we know, like museum work and nonprofits and NGOs and academia, of course. But I mean, there's consumer research, there's user experience. I mean, anthropologists can do anything. If you have what people eat in their homes and like how they talk about the food, but what they actually keep in their home. From 2005, and I messaged her. I was like, "Hey, I found this article from 2005." She's like, "What?" And you know, how'd you even find that? And I was like, "I was doing research for something else." And so I didn't know that she did that. So to me, I was like, "You're even more of a celebrity because you do work for Oprah." You know, like super cool. And so to just realize, like, anthropology is everywhere, and ethnography is needed in all industries and all things for media, for everything. So a lot of my goal is that, you know, is to like help. Bring that excitement and show people that it is everywhere, right? It's not just what is this degree? What can you do with this degree? It's like, I'm just going to point to the podcast and say, go here, pick an episode. That's what you can do with it. You know?
Yeah. That's a great way to put, you know, kind of like summarize your podcast, because I definitely think that that's what it does. And I'm actually in a graduate prep course right now where we're doing things like, you know, making a CV, get it, you know, statement of purpose, and, you know, being able to peer edit, but also having the teacher to kind of give us suggestions. And, you know, in like the group message, people were feeling like a little bit down about how COVID had kind of delayed, you know, some of their expectations for how their year would have gone. And I like really was lucky that I kind of started like internships and field work like right from freshman year for whatever reason. It ended up working out well, but I kind of had that like bug right away. And other people, you know, they found anthropology in college. I was super lucky. I came in, I knew exactly what I wanted to do. So I kind of hit the ground running. But, you know, some of them were asking me about how to find like opportunities, how to do all these things. And I was like, honestly, you have to go out and look for them. Like, I know that sounds intimidating and it sounds kind of stupid, but I said, do a Google search. Like, we love Google. That's a great place to start. I recommended some podcasts. I said, you know, we're in the age of like, you know, social media, and there are so many other ways to find mentors or people to interview or people that you can want advice from, other than just like the limited but still nice, you know, faculty and staff we have here at UCSB. And also, you know, learning about alternative career paths, like you were saying, from the traditional like academia, I'm trying to like champion that to this class. I'm like, come on, because I feel like our teacher, not like necessarily in a bad way, like a lot of her, because she isn't in academia, a lot of like the track for her in her vision like is, you know, academia, PhD. But yeah, so I hope maybe I can further, you know, I already put the link to your forensic anthro episode on my friend's anthropology class page, so everyone could listen to that one. She was really interesting.
Yeah, Lily White is great. Yeah.
Yeah, she was cool. And I loved like the special cover art that you did for that episode with like the coffin and the spider web. I was like, yeah. Oh, I love it.
little shout out. That's actually one of my interns, Sarah Schmieder, came up with that. So shout out to Sarah.
Oh, wonderful. Yeah. I've been so like lucky to collaborate with like one other student artist. And as someone who is not very artistic, I'm always just blown away with like what people put together and come up with. It's really, really
so
cool.
It is fun. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's, I mean, it's a cool thing too, because it's like podcasting is an audio medium, but at the same time, like, hey, you can do a video, but then you cannot like, there's show art. There's like so many other sort of sensorial aspects of it that you can play with that are that like, give it an extra boost of it. It's a creative enterprise, you know, which is cool.
Yeah. And it's also always fun to collaborate with others. Yeah.
Yeah, totally. And I just want to say, I applaud that you're helping try to get the class to think a little bit outside of the box. Yeah. It's important. It's really important to be able to do that. And like, and it is hard because it's like, we don't see outside our purview. Right. So we don't know where else to look. So you're doing the Lord's work there.
Thank you. And it's the first time that UCSB is offering this class in quite a while, so I think it'll kind of be nice. I'm sure we will all learn and be able to give the instructor feedback, you know, to continue it as a like class for future. It's designed for like junior seniors, you know, as they're going to grad school.
Cool.
So moving back to podcast things, what else is going on with you? What other projects or podcasts are you working on? Because I know you have a lot of irons in the fire.
That's a good website name, Irons in the Fire. Let's see if that's available. So kind of like what I said before is that podcasting itself has been super important to me, both as a career move and just again something that I love doing. And so to give like a quickish overview, like when I came back from fieldwork in 2016, I decided to like professionalize podcasting. I was like, I'm interested in this as a career path, I think, but just like as just like, what does it mean to professionalize this kind of work? So a couple things was that I really basically said, this is not to say this is a bad thing. I'm not going to claim this, but like, I'm going to stop talking about myself as a student. And a podcaster and just say, I'm a podcaster. It's fine that I'm a student too, but that doesn't really matter. That's not the identity of me as a podcaster in this case. And so I just like contemplated what would that look like, you know, and it actually looks the same, but, you know, it's just like, I wouldn't say it's a student podcast, for example, you know, and in part because then if I met new people, like if I meet someone at the academy, it doesn't really make a difference. Right. But it's like, if you meet someone that's outside of it, it sounds different to say I'm a podcaster versus I'm a student podcaster, right? Or it's like I'm a student pilot versus I'm a pilot,
yeah.
Right? And so that changed a bit of my mentality. And so I started networking like crazy. And that's when I started figuring out things like email marketing and like letting people know about the show. And so around this time, you know, 2017, 2018 is when ourselves and actually another podcast that was out of OSU called The Story of Us. We were the two founding members of the American Anthropological Association's like podcast network, the AAA network. And so that there was moments like this that were like this validation of like, okay, like the big dogs are looking at us and saying, hey, you guys, let's do a thing together, right?
Yeah. I love partnering with them. They're awesome.
Yeah, they're the best, you know? And it's been like, and so Jeff Martin that works with them and Ed Lebo and Leslie Walker, who was there at the time, he's now at the Smithsonian. You know, there was like a lot of really like kind folks that like said, y'all are doing the good work. Let's find ways to help promote these pieces of anthropology together. And, you know, recognizing that there's many ways to be anthropologists, and that was super validating. And so from that, basically I got an incredible opportunity in 2018 to, do a project with the AAA and the Smithsonian Folklife Festival. And normally AAA has done this, they've done a couple different things. They've done traveling exhibitions for the Folklife Festival. They've done one that was called World on the Move, 100,000 Years of Migration, that like talked about, you know, human evolution and change over time, but also like that. The idea is like, we've always been a migratory species. We've never been, I'm an American, right? Not a thing, right? And so they wanted to try something different in 2018. And so they basically pitched to me and to Story of Us, like, do y'all want to do a podcast thing? And I was like, me and the Smithsonian and AAA podcast? The answer is yes. And it turns out a Story of Us wasn't able to do it. So I got to use their slot too. So I got to go to DC for 2 weeks with AAA, so Leslie Walker and myself. We did 2 weeks of interviews with Smithsonian Folklife Festival participants. And we made a 5-part mini series that we ultimately called Culture Made, Heritage in a World on the Move. And that year they had folks from Armenia and Catalonia, as well as a Crafts of African Fashion Festival. And so super awesome, like incredible event, like, and it kind of blew my mind that we were able to do this. And so then we put together this 5-part series that was awesome, but kicked my butt, because normally like you do, like we do interview podcasts like this, and it takes time to edit one of these, right? As we both know, that was like, you know, 2 weeks worth of interviews, and then come back. And then my goal was to make it more NPR-ish. And so it's like, let's have multiple voices per episode with music and transitions and segments. Damn. Like that took a, like one episode that was like an hour. It took me like, you know, a month and a half to make, you know, and it really taught me a lot about, okay, this is what it's like to make an actual show. Like not that our shows are not actual shows, but to like to make a produced thing takes a lot of work.
Transitions really, understandable.
Yeah. But also like incredibly empowering, and to be like, okay, I could do this, you know? And I mean, now like the show's not super, super well made, but it was my first baby that was like this produced show, you know? But then that also made me realize that I'm doing more than just this anthro life. Like this anthro life was now this first thing, and it still exists, but then we've got Culture Made, which is like a TAL joint, but it's not the same thing. But it kind of lit the fire of like, let's do some more podcast stuff, you know? And so, I did that, and then that got me interested in what's happening in podcast land. And so I would a few times would go do a, or attempt to do like a presentation or paper or a panel or whatever at a AAA conference or a SFAA Society for Applied Anthro conference. And you'd always get like lukewarm reception. Like people are like, okay, you know, cool podcast paper, you know, like there, nobody cared, and that was okay. Like they don't have to care. But nobody was super interested. And so I was like, why don't anthropologists care about podcasting? You know, I mean, some do, but then I would go to, they said, fine, let me go to podcast conferences and talk about anthropology. And people are like, so into it. And it was like, oh, okay, I'm doing it backwards. And so, you know, I started doing things where I'd go speak at podcast conferences. I helped organize one here in Boston that's called Sound Education for the second year. That's like a festival of educational audio. And, you know, that's through that I got to meet a ton of, you know, folks that work at NPR and WGBH and like the shows that you've heard of, got to meet people that were working on these. And that was like a super interesting opportunity, as well as like here in attending podcast events and workshops. And I joined a community here that's put on by PRX, is also in Boston, which is the public radio exchange, which is like not an NPR competitor, but they're both like high level public radio producers. And like through that, I met a community, and I started working on a show called Fascina, invited to work on it by my colleague Eloisa Barbosa, who is Brazilian, and she, my wife is also Brazilian, so I'm learning Portuguese, or have been for a while. And so I met Eloisa one time at a podcast event. And so she asked me if I wanted to help her produce this show she's working on called Faxina, that was just accepted into the Google Podcast Creator Program, which is an international competition they do every year. 5,000 applicants, they pick 9 teams, and Faxina was selected. Wow. And so three of us joined up to make this. It's a Portuguese language narrative podcast that's like on par of what you hear on NPR with music transitions, narration, voices, that tells basically the hidden stories of domestic workers that traveled from Brazil to the US to do work. It's an incredible show. And I worked on season 1 with them. They're on season 2 now. I had to step away because it's insane amount of work. I'm super proud of them. But so working on that was also incredibly rewarding and difficult to do something in a second language, yeah, or a third language at this point. Wow. But to see that, and then also to see again, Google was interested in that kind of work, and getting to meet again the PRX team and meet folks that are at these echelons that are like making public radio happen. It's interesting to say, like, this is where I get super excited about. This is where podcasting and anthropology can go. I also co-host a show right now with a sociologist and a consultant named Gary David. The show is called Experience by Design. That's basically about our love of experience design. And similar to this, like it's a conversational interview show, pretty casual, but it's cool to see the audiences are different between that and this anthro life. If you look at stats, and so it's cool to realize we're reaching different kinds of folks. And that's a much more of a business show. Again, I also wanted to do that because it helped me learn business, and it's a language that I want to learn more of, I have done independent production stuff. I just worked on over the past 2 years, I've worked on a show as a producer called Miracle Renegade. That is a spiritual therapy podcast, which I super, super liked.
Wow. I love that though.
Yeah. Super nice. Like Maureen Whitehouse and Christian Camarena are the host of that. And it's Maureen's been like kind of like a spiritual guide for 20 plus years. And Christian was one of her former, but probably still kind of clients. And it's their conversations about trying to figure life out. Super cool. I get to put music behind it and edit it and put it together. And so it's a super diverse range of things, from narrative, Brazilian Portuguese shows and on domestic workers to spiritual therapy, to experience design, to anthropology, to Smithsonian stuff. So I don't know. I love it all. I think it's just such, there's so much to do. And sorry, I've been talking a lot. That's a lot.
No, that's that. All of it was so great to hear. And, it sounds like you really have been able to carve out such like a niche for yourself where you're thriving and like doing what you love, but also like making a profession out of it. That's such a cool thing. And I think you and I will have some like more off recording chats about just in general, like some podcast tips, because I think, I have a lot to learn as, just having this like as my solo show and, like running it out of my apartment. I definitely have aspirations like that just because I like you just love podcasting. I love listening to podcasts. I consume so many podcasts. It is ridiculous. Like it's amazing. It's become much better for me than TV. I also get headaches like all the time. And the Zoom school has been really hard because
no good.
It's like, well, I spend all day on the computer and then I want to take a break and I want to watch a TV show or I want to go on my phone and my head is just throbbing. But yeah.
Podcasts are good for the brain.
Podcasts are good for the brain. And so I don't have to like look at the screen too.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's nice. It's funny like now, cause I make my shows out of my apartment too. So that's fine to do. But it definitely is like, I don't have a commute. I work from home. Before the pandemic, I work from home. So it's like, I miss commute listening time, I guess. Like that's like the one thing I'm missing.
Yes. Driving and going somewhere is like the best time to listen to podcasts. Or I love listening to them when I'm cleaning. I just always need music or a podcast going at all times. So I was listening to you in another episode of a podcast and you brought up that you've actually done a bit of teaching. So I was kind of curious what perspectives and lessons you're bringing from your own creative work in the industry to help educate and like guide students and prospective anthropologists, whatever field they may, pursue.
Yeah. Teaching, education is like at the heart of what I do, and I love teaching, it's on one level, I only don't teach because I never could get paid to do it. Which someone says that means you're not good at it, but that's not true.
Yeah, no.
The academic system is just has no easy ways in, which I'm actually okay. I'm quite happy that I don't teach full time, but you know, similar to that, when I kind of like realized that there's a lot of value in bringing anthropology to podcasting versus bringing podcasting to anthropology. Conference wise, I realized that in similar with teaching, that's why I actually found I was able to, I felt like do the most good. I have taught anthropology programs that, you know, I've taught as an adjunct in a number of different schools. Like, and I've taught, you know, anthropology 101, mm-hmm. Archaeology 101, cultural anthropology 101. But I have also, in like more recently would teach in a design program. I taught in a design program for a few years and taught design research and design thinking and design discourse, which is actually around helping design students make arguments and like basically see their own perspective in the world. And I've taught it is like in products and marketing classes at engineering schools. And I've taught civic media in participatory design for a master's program. And, you know, so it's across these experiences, like it's been super interesting. And like, you know, teaching graduate students is a little bit different than teaching undergraduates, but at the same time, like there's such value in opportunity and seeing these cross spaces, these spaces of interaction and collaboration. So it's like having anthropology and civic design, having anthropology and design, having anthropology and engineering come together is I think really where sparks can fly. And so what I would try to kind of bring to student perspectives is if we're trying to solve problems is, actually, it's trying to help them realize this is how we, like, the fact is that we can solve problems. And what is it that we're taking from whatever discipline we're using to then solve these problems? And how do these pieces fit together? You know, and for me, that was trying to fill in a gap that I saw with anthropology is that we don't, like, we get taught how to think well, but not how to do anything with it often. And so to me, like, when you bring anthropology into a conversation with design or engineering, the first question is, well, why would you do that? What do they do together? You know, so the first question is, how do they work together? In order to answer that question, you have to be able to say, here's the problems that we can solve. And so just being aware of that and like helping frame things around solving problems versus just kind of unpacking or learning for learning's sake, which is important too. But like, mm-hmm. You know, let's get a pointer. Engineering is always like, well, I'm trying to make something optimized or make it more efficient, or I'm trying to fix something and make it work better. Design is similar. And to me, I think anthropology can do that well, and it can actually inform these other disciplines in incredible ways of like, how do we design for and with people, right? And so to me, that's been such a big piece, you know, and like in the civic media program, for example, when I was teaching master's students, you know, we were doing participatory design, which is designing for, with, and alongside stakeholders. And the lesson, the week that I got some of the biggest feedback that this is working from the students is when we did a project on aligning values with the outputs. And so like defining their values and then defining their stakeholder and their people they're designing with their values, and then aligning them. Like, do you guys care about trust, or do you care about transparency or accountability or whatever it is? And that was like, came from my anthropological training of like understanding how are we like representing the people that we're working with, you know? And so seeing basically that's what made design make sense to them was incredibly empowering to me. But then that taught me this is how we can empower and realize this is the power of these pieces together. So similar to your point of like your class of working with your students, your folks to say, let's think outside of the box of just like, what can we do with our degree or a thing? Mm-hmm. It's helping people realize that once you just ask the question of another discipline or another idea, you have to be able to answer, how do these work together? And that's an incredibly liberating question, you know, because it's like, it makes the ideas actionable. And so a lot of it has been pressed, I guess, in that, you know. You know, the other sides of it too is like, you know, making them make a podcast or a website could be good. You know, I don't force people to make stuff. You know, it's fun. I like when they do that. I like when, you know, I would let them easily make a podcast for a final project, mm-hmm. or stuff like that, you know. I'm on pause from teaching right now, you know, at the time of recording of this. And so we'll see if I go back at some point. But it's actually been helpful too, because my other thing is I realized after teaching for a number of years that it would be good for me to then not teach, work in industry, because the lens is totally different. The speed is different. The output is different. You get paid for different reasons. And so that's stuff I can all take back to teaching later on too, you know? So it's like, it all builds on itself, I think.
Yeah. It'll just benefit your future perspective. Yeah. So the panel that we were on together, which is called Increasing the Visibility of, okay. Start that statement over.
All good.
You and I were on a panel together called Increasing the Visibility of Anthropology, which was put together by Matt Art, featuring Amy Santee, Phil Surleys, Adam, and myself, which in case anyone's interested, you can find on YouTube just by typing that in, and I'll also like link it in the episode notes. But something that we kind of all like ended up throwing around as an idea, like at the end, was deconstructing this idea of like a PhD or master's thesis, and instead like supporting these creative projects and extending the scope of academic products. So it's actually like, before I ask you like your take on it, it's actually since then, and like I've a couple other conversations I've had with people on my episodes and with other people in the field since then, I've really been playing around with this idea. Oh, and Gary is one of them, talking about, you know, like the transitioning of like teaching and like putting out like educational modules almost that are different than a podcast episode. Like a podcast episode hits like a certain audience, but I've almost been thinking about how I can like address like a younger audience where like they're still learning like the tools of like, you know, even as simple as like hypothesis and what anthropology is generally and like human anatomy. And so I have like this kind of idea in the back of my head that I'm actually super happy I'm going to actually be working on next year with a school, is like this idea of how to teach anthropology to like younger than high school students. So very kind cool. of like where do, I don't know, what do you see as like creating, you were kind of saying like, you know, you could see your class creating a creative project, but I don't know, how can we like further incorporate these like new ideas of, you know, creativity and design like into master's or PhD programs?
Yeah, I mean, we need to, for one, you know, I will say like, I'm super bummed that it's like, I don't know what to do with my dissertation. I would love to make it into a book, but like that's, you like, you write a book and then you have to translate it into a book if you want to publish it. And that's crazy. Like, you like write a book length manuscript and then it lives in a library. Mm-hmm. So if any listeners want to help me do this, then let me know. but seriously, I would love help with that. But, you know, other than that, yes, I mean, there's so much we could do. Right. And so I think like, there's kind of two like broad axes that I would, you know, say to professors or students to think about. One is, you know, if it's a master's degree or a PhD project, or even like a senior thesis, it doesn't really matter. It's like, how do you demonstrate that you've mastered the concepts that you are learning? And then what are your goals with the things that you're doing, right? And so instead, then how do we just basically match the outputs with your goals? And I think that's not crazy. It's not that hard to do. It's just like, I will appreciate it. My advisor, Elizabeth Ferry, she won for one of the classes that I was in during PhD. She let me do a podcast as my final project, you know, in like 2014, early on. And I appreciate that. But I remember she said, she's like, yeah, you know, we could try that. You know, she said, I have to think about how to evaluate it. And I said, mm-hmm. That's good. So, you know, like, and that stuck with me because that's the question. If you're a professor or you're the evaluator, it is that question of how do I, you know, if I have a paper, I can kind of go through it and are you hitting the points, right? I mean, a podcast is the same thing. You just listen to it versus reading it on one level. But you know, contemplating, if the goal is to have your students or yourself demonstrate a certain level of knowledge, that's great. You know, so think about how would you be able to do that? And like, could a painting do that? Maybe. It depends what you're trying to paint, right? I mean, a podcast seems almost easy, right? Compared to like making a visual demonstration or like, but I mean, imagine a museum exhibition, you could totally demonstrate your knowledge on something. Putting together a like pitch deck as if you're like going to Shark Tank would be a really interesting way to say, I've learned these things. Here's the business application of it. You know, so I think like making a screenplay. I mean, there's so many even writing, there's so many written ways you could even express mm-hmm. the way that you've mastered these pieces of knowledge. I mean, I would love to see a novella that like is like ethnographic, right?
Yes.
One time, I don't remember now what year, we're just going to say 2015, because I'm just going to make that year of everything, maybe 2016. We did a panel at the American Anthropological Association meeting that we called Story Slamming Anthropology, Ethnography for the Rest of Us. And it was, basically like we said, you can't write a paper, you have to write a story that's ethnographic and you have to perform it at the panel. And that was the criteria. And it was like super fun. It was a well-attended event. And like, I mean, it didn't like didn't change the universe or anything, but like it showed us that there was like interest in let's be more literary. It's okay. Anthropology is incredibly literary, right? You read an ethnography. It's like Claude Levi-Strauss wanted to be a novelist and he just failed and then became an ethnographer. I think seriously, like, so, you know, it's like, it's okay to be poetic. And Michael Jackson, not the pop singer, the anthropologist, the existential anthropologist, is an incredible writer and like so poetic, and Paul Stoller also. And it's, so it's interesting, like there's so many really good writers out there that could like just put these different pieces. I mean, even like Ruth Benedict and Margaret Mead, the way they wrote was fun, you know? And the fact that Margaret Mead wrote for Red Book for years, you know, which is like old school version of Reader's Digest, was an old school version of, I don't know, Medium, you know, that like that tons of people read. And Paul Stoller now writes for he does blog stuff all the time, you know, for Huffington Post and Washington Post and stuff. So it's like, there's so many opportunities to express this kind of work that like, it's just like, why not do it? You know, mm-hmm. it's to me, it's so exciting. Like, yeah. Let's get some, like, do an op-ed as your final paper. Awesome. Right. That'd be cool.
That is cool. I agree with that. Well, thank you so much for chatting with me today. That everything we talked about was, you know, so fun and so wonderful. And I really hope our listeners got something out of it. And definitely check out this AnthroLife. I mean, if you like my podcast, you're going to love Adam. So here we go. And, yeah, you know, maybe you'll see me on an episode of this AnthroLife in the future.
you in fact will, listeners. We're gonna prognosticate the future here.
Yeah.
You'll see Gabby over there as well. Over here, over there, over somewhere.
Yeah. Yep. Thank you.
Cool. Thanks so much.